Turn our Bibles again to Luke chapter 14. And it's been a busy week in the ministry of Jesus. He's interacted with the full spectrum of society as usual. He's feeling drained and tired. And now it's the Sabbath, and he can rest again, and he's been invited out to dinner. But this won't be a quiet Sabbath afternoon. The organizers and the guests at this dinner are the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, the religious leaders. But we also encounter this slightly out of place figure, this man with dropsy, medical condition where you'd retain water and you'd swell. Quite peculiarly placed at this dinner party, a symbol of impurity and sin. And Jesus has a word for both of these characters at this dinner. Except usually Jesus is the one being interrogated by the Pharisees. Whereas on this occasion, it's Jesus who's doing the interrogation. He's seizing his captive audience. He's going out of his way to irritate and provoke and challenge them. And it's this interaction then between the Pharisees and Jesus, Jesus' intention to provoke them, which we'll be considering this morning. And we're going to divide our passage into two chunks. The first chunk, we'll see how Jesus provokes the Pharisees through a range of teaching points and parables and principles. And what he's doing is he's getting at the deep-seated prejudices and attitudes which these Pharisees are harboring in their hearts, and he's turning the knife. He's getting them to deeply self-reflect on themselves. But the teaching and the principles, they are a little bit, perhaps at first sight, hard to piece together. And that's where we come to the second chunk of the passage, where all of these teaching points and provocations, they all seem to come together in one final parable. In verses 15 to 24, Jesus issues this one final parable, which sort of summarizes everything he's been saying so far. And it really gets to the heart of Jesus' message for the Pharisees, for the whole of Israel, and even for us, as he teaches them on that Sabbath day afternoon. And so the first point that I want us to consider, the first provocation of Jesus on this occasion, is this. It's a point about a true Sabbath. A point about a true Sabbath. And that's in verses 1 to 6. That's the first part of that first chunk that we'll be considering, verses 1 to 6. So what do we see Jesus doing here? Well, he begins, doesn't he, in verse 3, by asking a very leading question. He says, is it lawful to heal a man on the Sabbath or not? Is it lawful to heal a man on the Sabbath or not? Now, both we and the Pharisees who are here on this occasion know exactly what Jesus thinks about that question. He's healed plenty of people on the Sabbath before. In fact, in just the previous chapter, a very similar event has taken place. Jesus healed a disabled woman, and the Pharisees on that occasion, they complain. They say there are six perfectly good days to be healed on. Why the Sabbath? And Jesus answers by saying that this woman, a daughter of Abraham, who Satan has bound for 18 years, should be loosed from her bonds on the Sabbath day. That's what he teaches. So they know exactly what he thinks about this question. But for some reason, on this occasion, the Pharisees don't take the bait. There's just a bit of an awkward silence. You sense everything's just a bit uneasy. And instead, then, he gives them his own very bold answer to that question. He doesn't just provide them with his own opinion. No, as if to irritate them, he miraculously heals this character, this man with dropsy, this health condition, on the Sabbath day, no less. And you read that and you think, really, Jesus? Couldn't you just engage in some polite discussion with the Pharisees? Are you trying to do yourself in? Are you trying to get them annoyed? And yet there's no Pharisee response. The silence, awkward, it just continues. But he doesn't leave it there. No, he pushes it one step further. He gives them an illustration. He says in verse 5, "Which of you, having a son or an ox that has fallen into a well on the Sabbath day, will not immediately pull him out?" You see what Jesus is doing? He's appealing to their common sense. He's saying, are you really going to leave your child in a pit all day while you go off and enjoy the Sabbath? Is that really your approach to this situation? And if you wouldn't leave your child in a pit all day, then what then is so unnatural about this healing on the Sabbath? In chapter 14, however, the awkwardness continues. There is no response to Jesus' teaching. So we need to ask the question then, what is Jesus trying to achieve by this provocation? Why is he irritating them in this fashion? Well, firstly, I think we can say he's just simply getting at the deep irrationality, the inconsistency in the Pharisees' religion. I mean, they're teaching things that these rules of theirs concerning the Sabbath, they're completely contrary to common sense. They're just baseless rules. They don't make any sense at all. Why is that? Why is it that Jesus' teaching causes them so much discomfort on this point? Well, I think it's because their rules about the Sabbath day, they didn't arise from a genuine religious piety. They weren't genuinely concerned about what God wanted, or not with from genuine hearts of love. No, rather, they had these rules in place as a mask for dark and ugly attitudes which they were harboring under the surface. You see, this man with dropsy and all of the sick and the poor and the diseased, as far as the Pharisees were concerned, these people were objects of shame. They were undeserving of society's love. And the Pharisees, they saw themselves above these people. Yes, they might have preached compassion on occasion. They might have encouraged other people to give alms to the poor, but they were all too ready to invent silly rules that prevented them from really acting seriously, to engaging in serious dignity-sacrificing love towards these people. And so Jesus is provoking their consciences, isn't he? He's getting at the heart of the Pharisee religion. He's exposing their selfishness. And he's showing them that their real reasons for not engaging with the poor and the sick and this man with dropsy is because they have dark hearts which put themselves above the needs of others. Decades later, Jesus' brother, James, he would have cause to remember the active compassion that Jesus lived out in his ministry. He would write in his epistle, he would say in chapter 1, verse 27 of James, he'd say, "Religion that is pure and undefiled before God the Father is this, to visit orphans and widows in their affliction and to keep oneself unstained from the world." Of course, such a statement would have been unintelligible to most of the Pharisees. You see, to them, keeping oneself unstained from the world meant avoiding the disadvantaged, like this man with dropsy. Disadvantaged people like this were a threat to purity. They were defiled themselves, and reaching out to them risked your defilement. But to Jesus, you see, tending to this man was as instinctive to him and as natural as it would have been to pull a son or an ox out of a well. And we need to ask ourselves the question, does Jesus' teaching on this point touch a nerve with us as well? Does it provoke us? Do we feel awkward by all of his probing and provoking? I mean, is there part of us which recoils when we encounter the socially disadvantaged? It's very easy to rationalize our prejudices on this point, isn't it? We can just say that, you know, caring for the poor and these people, it's just the social gospel. We want nothing to do with that. Or we say Christians shouldn't involve themselves in political matters. Or we say, you know, caring for the poor is a moral minefield. It's much more complicated today than it was in Jesus' day. And of course, there's truth in all of these statements, but we must be so careful as to how we approach this matter. Because daily we are confronted with the social outcasts of society. We meet homeless people. But even if we're not meeting, you know, homeless people or drug addicted people, we're still meeting people who are stigmatized for various reasons. They might be mentally ill, they might be disabled, they might struggle with something. And the Pharisee attitude in our hearts is never far away, is it? That sense of, I'm too good for this. I don't want to involve myself in that. That's too shameful. It's too awkward. I don't want to deal with it. That comes just as instinctive to us as it did to those in Jesus' day. So we need to take the time to consider how we can imprint Christ's example of pure and undefiled religion on our hearts, don't we? We need to think carefully about how we can do what Jesus did in this situation, how we can reach out to these people. So that's part of what Jesus is doing. He's provoking the Pharisees' heart. He's telling it as it is. He's provoking this cold-hearted religion. That's plain. But I also want to suggest that there is a deeper reason for Jesus' provocation. He's angling at something which is a bit more fundamental than what I'm talking about there. I said a moment ago that he's making a point about true Sabbath. That's why I said specifically my point was a point about true Sabbath. And clearly then, by this discussion, Jesus is encouraging the Pharisees to think about the deep point behind Sabbath rest. By asking these annoying questions and by performing this healing, he's making a big point about what the Sabbath day really means. And I think the point he's making is this, that there is absolutely no problem with healing on the Sabbath day, because in actual fact, healing and the Sabbath go hand in hand. Healing and the Sabbath go hand in hand. Now, what do I mean by that exactly? Well, we said a moment ago that the issue over the Sabbath day and Jesus' healing on that day had been a source of friction between Jesus and the Pharisees in the past. And part of the reason for that was because Jesus had acted as if he had a certain kind of authority on this matter of the Sabbath. So in the book of Matthew, chapter 12, Jesus tells the Pharisees these familiar words. He says, the Son of Man is Lord over the Sabbath. He acted as if he had a certain authority over that matter. Just previous to that, he said to the crowds, come to me and find rest. He declared himself to be a sort of Sabbath rest. Now, these were bold and authoritative and very offensive comments. He was claiming to be the dispenser of true Sabbath rest. But I think there's even a little bit more than that going on. You see, I think Jesus, in healing this man on the Sabbath, he has an eternal perspective in mind. Earlier in the book of Luke, in chapter 4, we find Jesus in a synagogue. It's a familiar scene. And on that occasion, he has the audacity to stand before those people in the synagogue, and he takes the book of Isaiah, and he reads these words. He says, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. And he says that those words are fulfilled in their hearing. What was the year of the Lord's favor? Well, Isaiah, in writing those words, was referring to the Jewish year of Jubilee. That was every 50th year, which was set aside as a sort of Sabbath year, a year of rest, a year of celebration. It was a sort of Sabbath of Sabbaths. On that year, the prisoners would be freed and debts would be forgiven. It was the ultimate Sabbath year in the Jewish calendar. And in quoting Isaiah, then, Jesus is referring to something, I think, above and beyond just that Sabbath year. No, he's saying in their hearing in that synagogue that it's part of his mission to proclaim a final true rest, a final true ultimate Sabbath at the end of all history. That's what he's come to proclaim. And what will be the characterizing nature of that Sabbath? Well, it'll be liberty to the captives and sight to the blind. It'll be healing. It'll be deep and true rest from the wages of sin. And he's saying then it's part of his mission to proclaim that true ultimate Sabbath. And so here's the thing about our passage then. When Jesus boldly heals this man with dropsy on the Sabbath, he's not merely attempting to wind up the Pharisees. No, it's part of his proclamation of that great Sabbath. The same goes for his healing of the disabled lady who's loosed from her bonds of Satan in the previous chapter. He's saying to the people hearing him loudly and clearly that there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. That's the language of Hebrews. And as far as that final Sabbath is concerned, healing will by no means be prevented. It cannot be prohibited. No, on that day, healing will abound. There'll be perfect liberty, perfect healing. It's a bit like when you're on a long walk and you've got an ultimate destination point, maybe it's several days, and occasionally on that walk, you'll take a rest day. And you'll just relax and you'll enjoy the rest and then you'll carry on walking the next day. But nothing can beat the proper relaxation that ends that journey when you can rest from the journey in completion. And it's a bit like that, isn't it? These Sabbaths that we enjoy Sunday by Sunday, we're able to relax, we're able to restore, we're able to get back together and enjoy the pleasures of fellowship. But they're just a tiny hint, a foretaste of one final Sabbath which is to come. And on that day, Jesus is saying, healing will abound, rest will be complete, rest and restoration will go hand in hand. So that's the first provocation then, the first point Jesus is making. It's a point about true Sabbath. But secondly, I think Jesus then goes on to make a point about true status. A point about true status. And that's the second part of our first chunk of this passage. So we're looking at verses 7 to 14 now. Now we're told at the beginning of our passage that they were watching Jesus very carefully. But now in verse 7, we see that Jesus has also been paying attention. He's noticed how the Pharisees have been choosing their places of honor around that table. And having observed that, he now adopts a new line of attack. He doesn't ask them any more questions. He just goes on the offensive. He issues two pieces of practical advice. And it's personal and it's pointed. And the first advice we see is in verses 7 to 11. And that concerns what to do if you're invited to a dinner, to a wedding feast. And the second piece of advice is in verses 12 to 14, and that concerns what to do if you're the one hosting the dinner, if you're the one inviting the guests. But in both cases, I think the principle, the underlying principle, is the same. So briefly, what is the practical advice which Jesus gives these Pharisees? Well, firstly, he says, if you're invited to the dinner, this is verses 7 to 11, if you're invited to the dinner, don't presume the place of honour at the table. Don't sit down in the esteemed seat. No, that's far too risky a strategy. That won't pay off in the long run. At some point, a more distinguished guest is going to enter the room and you're going to be told to move down the table. And it'll be a great social embarrassment. It'll be terribly humiliating. And everyone will see just how inflated a view you had of yourself. No, it's far better to take the lower seat. At least then there's the chance that you might be moved up the table. And at one level then, it's just sensible, pragmatic advice. Yes, it was painful for the Pharisees to hear about at that time because he's commenting on what they're doing at that table. But you'd think that most people would be prepared to at least concede this point if they thought about it for a bit. Yeah, that sort of makes sense. That's good practical advice. Just take the lower seat, that way you'll be moved up. The second piece of advice is the reverse scenario. It's this situation where you're the one hosting the dinner. And his advice here is that you don't prioritize the dignified guests, the kind of people you know who can repay you. No, it's better to prioritize the poor, the lame, the crippled, and the blind. And on this occasion, the advice is a little bit more confusing, isn't it? I mean, it doesn't seem to pragmatically make sense. Why would you invite the lame, the crippled, the blind, the poor to your social events? Well, Jesus' answer is, you'll be blessed because they cannot repay you. But that sounded like a contradiction in terms, as far as the Pharisees were concerned. That didn't seem socially sensible. But here's the thing. In both cases, in both scenarios, Jesus is not just giving pragmatic advice. No, he has a bigger picture in view. It soon becomes clear that he sees an eternal significance to what goes on at these dinner parties. Notice how he ends his first piece of advice in verse 11 with a very broad principle. He says, "For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and everyone who humbles himself will be exalted." What does Jesus mean by that? Well, he's picturing a time, isn't he, when there'll be a great humbling of the self-exalted people and a great exaltation of the self-humbling people. There is coming a day when the tables will be turned, to pardon the pun. And on that day, your pride will not be merely unwise, but it will be fatal. And your humility and your humbleness will not merely be prudent in that situation. Rather, it will be absolutely essential, because everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and everyone who humbles himself will be exalted. And then he adds even more clarity to what he's talking about here after his second piece of advice. In what way will you be blessed when you care for those who can't repay you, when you invite the crippled and the poor and all these folk to your feasts? Why is that good? How will you be repaid? Well, he says you'll be repaid at the resurrection of the just. The resurrection, that great day at the end of time, it'll be a day of great exaltation and a day of great humbling. That's what Jesus has in mind as he's issuing this advice. It'll be a day when all people are raised from the dead and God judges the living and the dead, and it'll be a day of reckoning and it'll be a day of repayment. So that's what he has in mind as he's issuing these pieces of advice. He's seeing an eternal significance to what's happening around those dinner tables, and he's seeing it in the context of what is to come at the resurrection of the just, when your pride will not be advantageous, it'll be your downfall. And one of the reasons why this advice then was so cutting to the Pharisees was because it was the Pharisees who embraced this idea of resurrection, wasn't it? Unlike other religious sects, like the Sadducees, the Pharisees taught that the dead would be raised. That was a distinctive in their theology. They held the doctrine of the resurrection. But you see, now Jesus is taking that belief, he's taking that doctrine, and he's presenting it to them in a way they'd never thought of before. See, perhaps the Pharisees were the kind of people who saw the final resurrection as a day when their social status would be preserved. Perhaps they saw themselves as occupying the seats of honor, a status of honor and dignity in the coming kingdom of God. That's what they were looking forward to. But here you see Jesus is challenging those deep-seated inclinations. And this is what he's saying. He's saying, you may attend your dinner parties with a proud heart and with the expectation that your status will be revered, that you can just wander up to your seat of honor and look down the table at your underlings. And in fact, you might host your dinner parties with that same proud heart, inviting the most distinguished guests, those people who can repay you back. But the reality is, if you don't change your ways and you think you can march into the resurrection of the just with that same proud heart, that you can just march into your seats in the kingdom of God and preserve your self-exalting status, then let me tell you, you are in for an unpleasant surprise. Because on that day, Pharisees, your pride will be your downfall. You need to humble yourself before it's too late. So I hope you can see then how Jesus' advice, it really does provoke these people. Well, that's what it's intending to do. On the surface, it might just look like some innocuous parables, just some interesting stories, just some teaching points which people can mull over the dinner table. Well, in reality, it's a biting provocation. It's an attempt to get the Pharisees to think about themselves at a deep level, to be concerned about themselves. So, two provocations. He's making a point about Sabbaths, that great and final Sabbath which is to come, and the fact that healing and the Sabbath rest are not inconsistent. And he's making a point about status, the fact that you can't just preserve your status as you march with pride into the resurrection of the just. No, on that day you will discover your true status before God if you do not humble yourself. So they're my first two points, and I hope I haven't confused you too much. You might have a lot of principles and confusing teaching at this point sort of circling in your head. We've got Jesus talking about this issue of healing and Sabbath and resurrection and pride and humility. And we'll come on to the application of these points in just a moment. But before we get there, we need to see that clearly some of the Pharisees felt a similar way about Jesus' teaching. Their heads were swimming, and they were left searching for words. They didn't know how to respond to him. But more than that, they were left feeling hurt and confused and awkward. But surprisingly, you don't get a sense of any humility in this passage. You don't get a sense of them conceding any of Jesus' points. No, all you get is verse 15. You get this little throwaway comment made by a Pharisee. One of the Pharisees, one of those who reclined at table with him, when he heard these things, he said to him, "Blessed is everyone who will eat bread in the kingdom of heaven." That's what he says. He says, "Blessed is everyone who will eat bread in the kingdom of heaven." That's his reply to what Jesus said. And that maybe sounds like an innocent little comment as it stands. I mean, presumably this guest thought he was agreeing with Jesus' sentiment. And yet, in the context of all that Jesus has just done and said, such a little comment betrays so much ignorance. It betrays the fact that this Pharisee has clearly not comprehended what Jesus has been talking about. And as such then, it's the sort of the straw which breaks the camel's back. It propels Jesus to bring all of these principles and teaching points together into one final parable, one final expose of the Pharisee's heart, and one final proclamation of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And it's this parable then that we read of in verses 16 to 24, and that's where we'll rest our thoughts this evening. So that third parable is my third point, and it's a parable about the true supper. A parable about the true supper. Sorry if I'm saying evening instead of morning, it's a habit of mine. I'll overcome it eventually. Parable about the true supper. And by supper, I am talking about the heavenly banquet at the end of history, which this parable is so clearly pointing towards. So, verses 16 to 24. Briefly then, what is this story about? This parable. Well, it's a story about a man who hosts a banquet. And he begins by inviting people of social substance. But there's a twist. The dignified people, who you'd think would come to this wedding, this banquet rather, they refuse the invitation, making various excuses. And that angers the host, who, in an even more exaggerated twist, then does something even more extraordinary. He invites the lowest of the low, the riffraff. Anyone and everyone can now join this banquet. They're all invited to the banquet. So that's the story. Well, what's Jesus' big point in this parable then? Well, once again, I think he's getting at the pride of the Pharisees. This is a parable about pride. Once again, it was a wake-up call to all of the proud religious people who were sitting around that table, just assuming that one day they'd also be feasting at the heavenly banquet. And why was it a wake-up call? Well, it was a wake-up call because Jesus is saying in this parable loudly and clearly that these proud religious leaders, they are just like the folk in the parable who refused their invitations to the banquet. They might not know it, but out of pride, they too are refusing their invitation to the heavenly supper. So you see what it was about that guest's comment, which was just so ironic. Yeah, here he is just assuming then that he's going to be going to this heavenly banquet. Blessed are those who will eat bread in the kingdom of God. Jesus is saying, no, you are the kind of person who's refused this wedding, this banquet invitation. But what was it exactly about the guests in the story who refused the invitation that angered the host so much? Why was the host of this banquet so angry? It says he became angry. Why did he find their excuses so infuriating? Well, as I say, it was their pride. This is a parable about pride. You see, in ancient culture, to be invited to a banquet was a great honor. It was an opportunity to receive privilege. You'd never refuse an invitation like that unless you had an exceptionally good excuse. And by refusing, you were not simply acting irrationally, you were acting spitefully. It was an offense to the host. You were saying that your trivial little affairs were more worth than the host was, than this opportunity to meet with these people was. In short, then, it took a baffling level of self-estimation and pride to refuse a banquet invitation like this. And it's precisely then this kind of pride that was excluding these Pharisees from the glory of the resurrection, the true Sabbath rest, and the heavenly banquet. See, Jesus is saying to these people, don't you get it? One day you will see that you were all invited to my banquet, but just like these excuse makers in the parable, you too considered yourself too good to come. You are putting your self-exalting little affairs above the kingdom of God. Your desire for status is blocking you from entering. You're excluding yourself by your own pride. And if you carry on like this, you will anger the host and you will have only yourself to blame. And let me tell you this morning that you need to receive this parable. You might need to receive this parable as a warning. Do not be like these proud Pharisees. You see, for the Pharisees, their religion was little more than just a ladder. It was a ladder to social status, to honor. Yes, it often involved a show of humility, but at the end of the day, it was more about appearance and visibility. And occasions like this dinner that we see in chapter 14, well, they exposed the Pharisees' true heart. It removed the veil from their pride. Their piety was only skin deep. In reality, they were all about wanting honor and dignity. They were all about performance and pride. That was the real engine of their religion. And maybe for you then, pride is creeping into your Christianity. Modern Christianity has its own celebrities, doesn't it? It has the best preachers and the best campaigners and the Christian sports personalities and whatever it might be. And the allure of having that kind of visibility or being in the company of these people, being known by these people, that can be so strong, can't it? It can be such a tug on the heart. It gets at our pride. Even in small Christian circles, we can place certain people on a pedestal. We can celebrate them for their gifts and their virtues, and often for noble reasons. There's definitely a place for recognition, but there's not a place for pride. And growing as a Christian should never become the pursuit of recognition. So, by all means, do big things for God, but make sure that in doing big things for God, you're not actually just doing big things for your ego, because the Pharisee heart is never far away. So receive this as a warning, because clearly for many professing Christians, they've become so absorbed in their status, they're just marching towards heaven, expecting to be met with praise and adulation, expecting to hold on to their self-exaltation. And if you're one of these people, let me tell you that you're in for a nasty surprise, because you might find that on that day, the doors are shut to you, and your religion is exposed as never being more than just the worship of self. You exalted yourself in the here and now, but this won't last. You'll soon be humbled. So I'm telling you, be sobered by these words and humble yourself here and now before God. Come to him in submission, lay your pride at his feet, because it's better to humble yourself now than for someone else to humble you in eternity. But finally and briefly, there is more, isn't there, in this parable than just a warning going on. Because if you have humbled yourself before the Lord, then there's a word in this parable for you as well. If you are a follower of Jesus who knows full well your weakness and your frailty, if you know the sorrows of a broken life and a divided heart and the struggle against sin, if you are striving for righteousness but you know just how painful that can be and just how much of a struggle it is against the shackles of sin, and if you know in your heart of hearts this morning that there's nothing within you that can commend you before God except by his mercy, then I want to encourage you, because you also feature in this parable. You make your first appearance in verse 21. It says there, "Then the master of the house became angry and said to his servant, 'Go out quickly to the streets and the lanes of the city and bring in the poor and crippled and the blind and lame.'" And that's you. That's you. The crippled and the blind and lame. And the servant said, "Sir, what you commanded has been done and there is still room." And the master said, "Go out to the highways and hedges and compel people to come in, that my house may be filled." See, the truth is, there are no immaculate, radiant Christian celebrities as far as God's concerned. Because according to the mysterious wisdom of God, he didn't cherry pick the most gifted or the most intelligent or the most creative people for his kingdom. No, he didn't choose people of dignity for his table. If anything, he chose the riffraff, the lowest of the low. What does Corinthians tell us? It says, "Not many of you were wise according to worldly standards, not many were powerful, not many were of noble birth." You see, God doesn't operate by these same worldly standards. The truth is, all of us are debtors to mercy alone. We all owe our position in the kingdom to the love of God. And that should be of the greatest comfort to us, shouldn't it? Sometimes when we talk about heaven, we talk about looking forward to being able to speak with men like St. Paul, Jeremiah, or Calvin, or Luther, or whoever it might be. And yes, we will enjoy speaking to these great saints, but the truth is that these men never saw themselves as great saints. They saw themselves as ordinary believers like you and me, sinners saved by grace. And so I also want you to encourage you to look forward to a day when you can spend time and you can look up and down that heavenly banquet table and you see it's filled with the misfits, the misunderstood, the plain and simple people, the unextraordinary. At the end of the day, that's who we are, but by the grace of God, he has chosen ordinary folk like me and you for his kingdom. And the wonderful thing is that on that day, we will be glorified. We will be healed. It'll be a day of great rest. It'll be that great Sabbath day. We'll be restored and honored. And we have that fantastic day to look forward to, but more than just the joy of spending time with one another, we look forward to spending time with the host of that banquet, the very host who has sat at the table with these Pharisees, though they didn't know it. He will be there sharing that occasion with us. We'll be truly intimate with our Saviour, Jesus Christ. Amen.